You can use a couple of glass pack exhaust system on that.
Chrome stacks.
Is the system on? Good morning. The Board of Supervisors is now in session. If everyone would please rise and join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Take a deep breath.
Very deep.
Before we start our regularly scheduled board meeting today, I would like to take a moment of silence and memory for Rick May. Most people didn't recognize the fact that Rick May is Helen May's grandson. Helen May is a longtime activist in this county, and Rick was killed in the line of duty. So, a moment of silence, please. Thank you. With that, we will go to our first item, which is, yes, the reorganization of the Board of Supervisors. May we have a motion for chairman?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion to nominate Supervisor Asajjan for chairman for 2006.
May we have a voice vote, please. All in favor? Yes.
Aye.
Any opposed? None. Mr. Asajjan.
Thank you, Madam outgoing chairwoman. On behalf of my colleagues and staff, we want to thank you for the great job you have done as chairperson for the year past, and thanks for everything. And with this plaque, I declare you the queen forever.
Thank you. Thank you all very, very much.
You're welcome to say a few words if you would like.
Well, let's shift and then I'll...
Shift.
We'll shift down. Shift. Yes.
She would probably do that if necessary, yeah.
Well, you know, it's true. It's funny to sit in this room at a different angle. It truly is not possible to be a how will I phrase it? An effective chair without the support of our support staff. And I particularly would like to thank the staff that we have up in the board chambers. I got through this year, which was a little more difficult than usual, and I couldn't have done it without the help of our secretary, Sherry Isperro, and Fran Zons isn't here yet. She's part-time, but she helped. She helped tremendously, too, and I'd like to thank all of our staff. And I couldn't do it without my legislative assistant, Richard Macedo, who is also in the front row. And then the guy sitting on my right, David Edge. He makes a wonderful support person. He really does. For one thing, his sense of humor is as sick as mine. So with that, yes.
Thank you. With that, I would like to welcome you all to our January 10th meeting. And Madam Clerk, would you please read the changes to our agenda?
Would you like to have an election for vice chair first?
Yes, please.
So we did this to Shirley, too, so don't feel like you're going to get out of it.
Okay,
well, he never misses a meeting.
Yeah.
I would
move for Jerry Lenthal as vice chair.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Seeing none, with a voice call, Madam Clerk.
Mm-hmm. Voice.
All those in favor?
Aye. Yes.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. Congratulations.
Okay, the changes to today's agendas. Added items on consent are B-22, submittal from the Administrative Office, Office of Emergency Services, of a resolution extending the proclamation of local emergency that was ratified by the Board of Supervisors on January 5th, 2006. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign. B-23 is a submittal from the Board of Supervisors of a resolution recognizing Rick Torbrook, for more than 37 years of service in law enforcement. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign. B-24 is submittal from the Board of Supervisors of a resolution recognizing Heather Jensen for 23 years of service to the Arroyo Grande Chamber of Commerce. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign. Added items on closed session under pending litigation, under a conference for legal counsel existing litigation, number 9, Napomo Community Services District versus the County of San Luis Obispo, et al. Also, conference with real property negotiator, number 10, property description 417.5 Orchard Avenue in Arroyo Grande, parties with whom negotiating, Campfire Boys and Girls, Joey Hughes, instructs to negotiator will concern terms and conditions. All the requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement. Added item on consent, B-18 is a request to 1. Approve the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise DBE program for the Public Works Department, 2. Authorize the Director of Public Works to sign and execute the plan for the county, and 3. Authorize staff submitting the plan to the California Department of Transportation, all districts. Recommend approval. Staff is requesting that due to a technical error in the staff report be replaced and the title on the cover sheet be amended to read as follows. Request to 1. Approve the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise DBE for the Department of Public Works, and 2. Authorize the submittal of this plan to the California Department of Transportation. Recommend approval. The replacement staff report is attached for your approval. And those are all the changes to today's agenda.
Thank you. With that, I would like to entertain a motion for the presentations.
Move. Second.
Moved by Supervisor Ovett, seconded by Supervisor Lenthal. Roll call, please.
Mr. Ovett?
Aye.
Mr. Lenthal?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Asajian?
Aye. Would you, Madam Clerk, introduce item A1?
A1 is the adoption and presentation of a resolution expressing support for the California Space Authority Space Center. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign.
Thank you. Ms. Bianchi, would you please read the resolution?
Yes. If Andrea C. Strand would come to the podium, please. Thank you. Whereas, this is a resolution expressing support for the California Space Authority's Space Center. Whereas space enterprise is paramount to the state's economic prosperity in that it contributes more than $10 billion each year, an amount representing 24% of the world's aerospace market. And whereas Vandenberg Air Force Base is an installation of about 99,000 acres on the central coast of California that serves as the nation's premier and first polar launch site and is home to 7 launch complexes and a commercial spaceport. And whereas Vandenberg Air Force Base contributes about $1 billion annually to the state's economy, and whereas the proposed California Space Center at Vandenberg Air Force Base could motivate students to study math, science, and engineering, now therefore may it be resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors that we hereby express our support for the California Space Authority's concept of a multipurpose California Space Center to be located on 66 acres along State Highway 1 outside the main gate of Vandenberg Air Force Base, comprising the following five elements: space-related visitor attractions, launch viewing suite, space education multipurpose area, conference center, and mission support complex. With that.
And you're welcome to say a few words if you would like to.
Well, need I say, the California Space Authority, and on behalf of our board of directors and all involved in this wonderful project, thank you very much. We are just at the beginning of a long journey, so please understand you will not see a building there tomorrow. Just to let you know where we are in the process, we have gotten great support from our congressional members, our state legislators, our supervisors in the two counties, and we're now talking to many cities in our two counties for support. The advisory group in this endeavor has, I guess that we could say, launched a launch team where we're going to raise some seed dollars for initial things that need to be done, environmental review and so on. We cannot really establish a capital campaign as yet until we actually have the Air Force lease in our hand. And that's what we're pursuing. We understand it will take a year to 18 months to be able to receive that the lease. And we have to do that through the Secretary of the Air Force. Once that is established, then we will have a tremendous capital campaign, and we anticipate that this project will take at least 10 years to 12 years to build out. We're looking, the architects tell us, between $80 to $100 million. But there are two important reasons that we see this needs to be done. We need to tell the story of the wonderful land from the Chumash to what is being done there now, to excite, as Ms. Bianca said, our children to study math and science. If you pick up the December issue of the Reader's Digest, there's an article there that is talking about the draining of our brain trust. And we're losing our scientists, we're losing our technicians, and we need to do something about it. So this is a step, I wouldn't say a complete step, but it is a step that we can do on the central coast of California to try and assist in the stopping of that brain drain. So beside that, I think it will be an economic benefit to the state of California and the central coast of California. So thank you again for this, and I look forward to working with you as this project goes on. And if you have any questions, naturally, always there to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item on our agenda is public comment period. First speaker is Eric Greening, followed by Reverend C. Height.
Good morning. I am Eric Greening. I'd like to thank Supervisor Bianchi for an exemplary year as your chair, and to welcome Cacho to that challenging task. This is a good time to assess progress in the last year and prepare to complete the unfinished business pending in the next. Looking back on 2005, I'd say two of the high points were your official adoption of SMART growth principles and your decision to begin updating our 31-year-old conservation element while incorporating within it our water master plan. Obviously, the real work on the conservation element lies ahead, and I'm hoping that 2006 will see us make a robust start. As you know, I would like to see the effort and expertise of the Water Resources Advisory Committee matched by similar efforts on biological and cultural resources. The challenge remaining relative to our SMART growth principles is to go through the ones we have adopted one by one assess whether and how each is or is not incorporated in our general plan and ordinances, get to work filling gaps as needed so that each is truly codified, and then establish procedures where they are attended to and not ignored in all relevant county decisions, whether routine or controversial. I'd suggest that you begin by planning an hour or two for agendas that are not yet full, where you take a principle a week and begin this review and examination preparatory to full and meaningful implementation. I'd like to wish you all a happy new year. This year began with a lot of something very much needed, rainfall, in a way that was truly a challenge as well as a blessing. The coming year will be full of challenges. May we rise to the occasion of those challenges so that the year will also be full of blessings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Reverend C. Hyde, followed by David Dugan.
Artist advocate, Reverend C. Hyde, M.A. It is a matter of public record that the county has public health care, affordable housing, public housing, and human services crisis. My survival in this county depends on the fact that I never fall, that I never chip a tooth, that I never associate or advocate for disabled people. Every human will become ill, will fall, will experience trauma, grow old, see their children in car accidents, and they will face a community that is openly hostile to the disabled. I have read in the paper that the county is conferencing with the city of San Luis Obispo, and that conferencing involves a $100,000 grant that was earmarked for housing and disabled accommodation. The county, your administrator, and your county council told you it was really okay to pursue your recommendations to undermine the ADA, and that was an assembly bill which failed. You were wrong in that. Well, there's a new assembly bill which is trying to get the state of California to comply with the ADA and the Olmstead Act and quit pushing people towards institutionalization. Failure is a financial irresponsibility to the taxpayer, but the county benefits from failure. If you divert the funds that are meant for compliance, any disabled litigant can now go into federal court and say, this is where it starts, with the city and the county of San Luis Obispo. They are openly hostile to disabled concerns. They're going to divert the funds. Do you want the state and federal government to say, well, gee, you know, you applied for these funds. They were meant to go to this. They're required to go to this. This is an affirmative action failure to even consider it. Do you want someone to be able to walk into federal court and say the systemic failure in the ADA begins with the county and the city of San Luis Obispo? When you conference with the city of San Luis Obispo about disabled concerns, the disabled people that are on housing are on Medi-Cal and you're conferencing for reasons other than improving their plan. That's against the Medi-Cal. You're not improving anything, you're taking something away. Now, my issue is, why can't the city finance what they need to finance? Well, they're spending over $1 million in Mardi Gras oppression. I have lived under martial law. I know what it is like. I know the fear of living under martial law. And what happens within the city happens within the county. And the county allowed this. It was martial law, and you allowed it. What happens with the city does involve the county. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dugan, followed by Jerry Seabuck.
Okay. Dave Dugan, Water Warrior, Vigilante, Pro-Growth, Republican, and resident of Bay Osos. Fines, fines, fines. I remember even before the recall election, some people were begging the Regional Water Quality Control Board to fine the LLCSD into bankruptcy.
I'll get him a day.
A matter of fact, the staff of the Regional Water Quality Control Board was already drafting the LCL complaint before the first vote was counted, 4 days before the final vote was counted, and the new LOCSD was sworn in. This is not conjecture, but a matter of public record. though there seems to be some ambiguity as to the why and when of the ACL complaint if you consider Roger Briggs' testimony. And let's consider the suspension of payments of the SRF loan, how the second request was resubmitted several times, each time for more money by the previous LOCSD board, and was withheld upon final request the day of the election, before the first vote was even counted, 5 days before work was suspended on the wastewater project. And I don't have to remind you of the false negotiation the State Water Resource Control Board and their staff entered into concerning the SRF money. They had no intention of negotiation, though a letter was sent to the Honorable Sam Blakesley authorizing an agreement for structured negotiations and signed by Executive Director Celeste Cantu. No, I'm not going to talk about that. I want to talk about instead and revisit September 27th, 2005, the day of the Los Osos CSD recall election, and what could have caused the staff of both water wards to ambush the Los Osos CSD even before the first vote was counted. Actually, that's not true. I remember the first absentee ballots were being counted on September 20th, 7 days before the election. That day, right here in this chamber, I warned of what might be happening to those absentee ballots. But perhaps I should have been more worried about the tally of the absentee ballot on election day and how that tally may have prompted the staff of both water boards to act before the polls had closed. Oh, that's right. It would be illegal to reveal that tally before the polls close. I guess it will have to remain a mystery of mysteries, or not. Just the same, right after I leave here, I just might go on over to the county clerk's office and make an inquiry. I'd also like to end with the LOCSD has allocated money to try to get roads fixed that were ripped up by the construction for the wastewater facility and such. I'd like to say this to the county. The county needs to come and fix some roads, too. They've neglected the roads in Los Osos for a long time, using the wastewater project as an excuse. And there's a lot of places where roads need to be fixed. And I hope you get on it. Thank you.
Sir Dugan, I didn't want to interrupt you, but can you give us your name for the record, please?
Dave Dugan.
Thank you.
That was the last item, last request to speak under public comment period. Next item will be presentations. And Mrs. York, would that be you, or would you please come forward and...
Item A2 is a presentation of employee service awards. Recommend approval.
The motion we had on the presentation covered that?
Well, let's do another motion.
So moved.
Second.
Okay.
And it's just a voice vote?
It does say roll call.
Oh, I did have the roll call?
Yeah. Would that, would you?
I can do a roll call. Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mr. Linthal.
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi.
Yes.
Mr. Ovitt.
Aye.
And Mr. Asajian.
Aye. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the board. I'm Mary York with the Personnel Department.
Microphone.
Gunderlach. We're honored to assist the board in your tradition of recognizing employees for their years of service. Today we're recognizing those with 25 years of service. I'd also like to thank Risk Management's Glenn Estrada and Susan Baker for their able support. The individuals being recognized today are the staff who, by time served, assigned responsibility, and example, continue to contribute on a daily basis to the county's vision of a safe, healthy, livable, prosperous, and well-governed community. As the names are announced, department heads, please approach the left podium, and employees proceed to the right podium. Before speaking, please provide your name and department for the record. After the award exchange, the employee is invited to make a brief statement if they wish and proceed to the board to shake their hands. And with that, I'd like to invite County Assessor Tom Bordenaro to the front and Dinah Leary.
Okay, that's Tom Bordenaro, County Assessor. Can that mic pick me up from this far back? Okay. All right, I'm very pleased to be here to help celebrate the 25-year recognition of Dinah Leary. Originally, Dinah planned to work in, I think it was regional planning, and for some reason, to our benefit, she decided to move into the appraisal community, and that was a great benefit to the assessor's office. Huge loss to planning. Sorry, planning. But we got her. You can't have her. She was hired in 1980 as an appraiser aide and worked her way up. She was recognized for her quality work, worked her way up to the appraiser 1, 2, 3, and 4. And yes, we did have appraiser 4s in those days, if Gail Wilcox is in the audience. She was promoted to assessment analyst 3 in August of 1991. And she's worked and directed assignments in our administrative and standards sections of the office ever since. She's gone above and beyond her normal duties. She served on various educational committees, including that of the California Assessors Administrative Services Association. She served on the County Employee and University Advisory Board, was one of our original county Stephen Covey trainers, continues to be a public speaker for my office in our outreach program. Dedicated, loyal, committed, trustworthy, dependable, courteous, and positive are just a few of the words that describe Dinah's work performance reviews over the past 25 years. She's one of those employees that will always go the extra mile to contribute to the office. She's an outstanding employee that we all wish what we had in our departments. So those are kind of the known facts. I got to give you a few kind of unknown facts about Dinah. She's one of the best volleyball players that we've ever seen. Both her and her husband, well, her husband thinks he is, but she really is the volleyball player of the family. She's made our assessor's team a champion for many years. Her organizational skills were quickly made the old weekly Friday night happy hour celebrations a huge success. We don't do those anymore, but it's rather unfortunate. And if you've not seen her or heard her rendition of La Bamba, it's won many county karaoke awards for the office. She's taken the definition of the April Fool's victim to a higher level. I didn't put gullible in there, but that's one of those other words that describes Dinah. And for those of you that don't know, she's the L.A. County champion burro racer. One of her biggest hobbies is riding burros in L.A., and if you want to know that story, you'll have to ask Dinah. But I'm proud to have her in our office, and we're pleased to know her as a colleague and a friend. She's a phenomenal county employee that has not only earned this recognition, but deserves, I think, everybody's congratulations and respect. Thank you, Dinah.
I just want to deny the latter half of everything he said. And I know where it came from. Thank you, Kirk. I do want to thank Tom Bordenaro and the members of the board for this recognition. I do appreciate it. And just to clarify how I came from regional planning into the assessor's office, I was working on my master's at Cal Poly on regional planning when Prop 13 passed. And I bailed because I figured there were no jobs left in planning. And as fate would have it, Prop 13 gave me a job in the assessor's office. So that's why I'm here. And thanks again very much.
Thank you. Before we go to the next person, the lady behind the cameraman wearing a maroon, would you please don't touch those lights? I know. Thank you. I'm glad she did that for me. Thank you. Next person, please.
Thank you. Behavioral Health Clinical Program Manager Brad Sanseri and Eric Burt, would you please come up?
Good morning. I'm Brad Sanseri, the Mental Health Youth Services Clinical Programs Manager, and it's my pleasure to speak to you on Eric's 25th anniversary. For over 25 years, Eric's been dedicated to working with children and families in the field of mental health in San Luis Obispo County. He began his work at Hotline, and I just learned that Kim Barrett, our Chief Probation Officer, helped train him. Following graduation from Cal Poly, I went to work for San Luis Obispo County Drug and Alcohol Services. Through the 80s, Eric was mental health placement case manager for children placed in foster homes, group homes, and residential facilities throughout California. He left mental health for 5 years to work as a family court mediator. Missing us at mental health, he returned to us to work with families in their homes, schools, and to prevent higher levels of care. He was also one of the original safe system of care therapists providing intensive services to children. In 1994, he transferred to youth services in San Luis Obispo, and he's been providing outpatient services in the clinic and schools serving children and families for the past 11 years. Eric's known by those that know him best as being very versatile and proficient at many things. At various points in his career, he's worked with the Mobile Crisis Service, the Probation Department, and he's been a foster parent. He's the go-to person in the office for computer, phone, copy machine, coffee machine, and other electronic malfunctions, which happen almost daily. But the best demonstration of Eric's versatility was last summer at his daughter's beautiful wedding on the beach in Cayucas. Eric took the ceremonial walk down the aisle with his daughter, where he left her, briefly, at the seaside altar. He returned within a couple of minutes, adorned in his pastoral robe, and performed the wedding in front of over 100 invited guests and an additional 100 people standing on the pier watching the ceremony. The wedding was followed by a great reception, and Eric and his wife graciously hosted everyone in that process. Thanks, Eric, for all your hard work, dedication, and friendship. Keep your sense of humor and stay on your toes. Who knows what the next 25 years will bring. Thanks.
I'd like to thank the board and Brad for this recognition. You know, I was hired by the county, Dan Wool, the drug program chief at the time, in May of 1977. I started at $4.77 an hour. And when he hired me, he told me this was a go-nowhere position. And I guess he was right, because I haven't gone anywhere. But I have really enjoyed my service for the county. I love working with kids, and I just thank you for this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. County Council Jim Lindholm and Jim Orton, would you please come forward?
Thank you. I'm Jim Lindholm, County Council. I appreciate the opportunity to recognize Jim Orton's 25 years of service to the citizens of San Luis Obispo County and to acknowledge Jim as a truly outstanding attorney and a valued member of the County Council's office. Jim grew up in California. He received his undergraduate degree in economics from Berkeley in 1967. He then served as a Navy lieutenant in the combat zone during the Vietnam War. He graduated from California Western School of Law in San Diego in 1973. He was an attorney in the Kings County Council's office before serving as a city attorney for the city of Santa Maria in 1979 to 1980. Jim joined the San Luis Obispo County Council's office in 1980. He has practiced mainly in the area of land use law, especially current planning and subdivisions. He's regarded by his county council colleagues here and in other counties as a valuable resource on land use law. He was selected by his fellow attorneys from other counties in the state to be the chairman of the County Council Association Land Use Law Section. Jim has also advised and assisted other clients over the years, including LAFCO and the Assessment Appeals Board. In addition to his exceptional contributions advising clients, Jim has successfully handled difficult litigation. Several of these cases resulted in significant contributions to the development of land use law in this county and in the state. Jim's years in San Luis Obispo have not been all work and no play. Jim and his wife, Tonya, have added new meaning to the term getting away. They are truly world travelers, having gone to places like Paris, where Tonya's daughter and family live, and most of Europe, Brazil, Japan, Korea, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, and China. Jim also has two beautiful, accomplished, and college-educated daughters, Ashley and Ryan. Thank you, Jim, for 25 years of outstanding service to the citizens of San Luis Obispo County. It's a pleasure to be working with you, and I'm looking forward to the future. Thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure serving the board and working in the county council's office. I particularly appreciate the professional atmosphere that the leadership of the office has created. It's a wonderful opportunity to work there, and I hope to have many more years to come. Thank you.
Thank you. General Services Director Dwayne Leib and Spence Graft, Jr., would you please come forward?
Thank you. Dwayne Leib, General Services Director. The County Fleet Operations is one of the divisions of General Services, and I've had the pleasure of working with Spence R. Graft, Jr., and I'd like to correct some misconceptions about his first name. Spence is his full name, not Spencer. It's a little bit confusing because his middle initial is R, so he's Spence R. Graft, Jr. Spence has spent most of his life in San Luis County. His father worked on the ranch at Hearst Castle, and his grandfather ran the Cayucas Vets Hall, one of our facilities, when Spence was in grammar school in Cayucas. Spence has been an employee of the Department of General Services for all of his 25 years. He started 25 years with the county. He started as an automotive service worker in 1980, just a few months after I arrived at General Services. He progressed up the ladder to automotive mechanic 1, then 2, then lead automotive mechanic, and finally garage manager five and a half years ago. I recognized his talents and decided I wanted to hold on to him and utilize some of his better talents. And a title, his title was changed about 2 years ago when we consolidated the county's fleet. And your board should be aware that our fleet has won national recognition under Spence's leadership. We were recently announced as one of the top 100 fleets in North America. And I think your board will get a chance to honor him again in the future when we bring a resolution back. His is a real success story that's only part of who he is. He's had a private life, and he has the same approach to his life overall that he's had with the county career. Balancing his county achievements with his private life, he has raced and won in motocross racing, mountain bike racing, both in downhill and cross country, winning a national event at the Keysville Classic. He is, or was, an avid wakeboarder until he broke a shoulder. But the part I've always been in awe about Spence was his automotive racing career. You know I'm somewhat of a motorhead. He started in micro midgets and worked his way up the ranks of open wheel race cars to become a fully sponsored sprint car driver, some of the most beastly race cars on the planet. And I should say that Spence is also an avid motorcyclist, and he and I ride together frequently. For Spence, nothing short of excellence will do, whether private or professional. I'm proud to have him as a fleet manager, proud of the state and national recognition he has achieved for our county, and proud to have the privilege of working with him for over 25 years. Thank you, Spence.
I don't
don't get a chance to speak much, so bear with me. I would like to thank the Board of Supervisors for this recognition of service award. Thank you. And also Dwayne Leib for the past 25 years of trust he has placed in me, with promoting me throughout the years from service worker until now fleet manager. The confidence that Dwayne had in me throughout the years has changed my life and my family's life. Since becoming a manager, George Rosenberger, has become a great source of information and advice. I look to George even at times for fatherly advice. George is the same age as my dad. Thanks, George. I work with some great people, like all of the GS managers who helped with my learning curve 5 years ago when I was promoted to fleet manager. Thank all of you. Bob, Klausha, Pete, Karen, Jim, and Cindy, you're all the best. Thanks to the entire General Services staff for the support they give to our fleet operation. They are what helped to make it successful. And thanks to the best staff a manager could ask for, the staff at Fleet Services. The biggest thanks of all, has to go to my wife. She supported my career and my many adventures throughout my life. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I will never look at George the same way again.
And Spence and Dwayne, I look forward to riding with you gentlemen May 13th. Put it on your calendar for the Slow Lift Poker Run. Mm-hmm. With that, Mary.
Thank you. Library Director Brian Reynolds and Judy Horner, please come forward.
Honorable Board, members of the audience, Brian Reynolds, Library Director. We're here to recognize two employees today working for 25 years for the library, and the first is Judy Horner. Judy Horner has been working in libraries in San Luis Obispo County for more than 25 years, having worked at the Paso Robles Library before joining the county system. Of course, that's a step up. Never mind. Since coming to us, she has worked on the Bookmobile and three other branches, Los Osos, Morro Bay, and San Luis Obispo. In each, she displayed a genuine eagerness to help the public, especially those children coming in whose reports that are due tomorrow, a warmth that draws people to her, and a whimsical sense of humor that leads to some very interesting and entertaining Halloween costumes. In the Morro Bay branch, she did story times, school visits, and summer reading programs, but just 3 years ago, she took a leap into reference work in the San Luis Obispo City branch, where she has enhanced many of the skills she has learned over the years and added new skills, including a knowledge of the internet, to answer all the myriad questions that are posed on a daily basis in her new job. Her artistic talent expresses itself in ever-changing book displays. Judy is an asset to the community in general and a dedicated worker for the public through her work in our county library system. Thank you, Judy.
Thank you, everybody. It's been a pleasure.
Come on over, Judy. You can't run away like that, Wanda. Thank you. We don't bite.
Thank you. Phyllis Lynch?
Phyllis is another icon of our system. Starting as a volunteer in 1977 at the Arroyo Grande Library, located on Bridge Street, Phyllis was hired as a 10-hour clerk typist in 1980, when the present-day library opened in the South County Regional Center. Gradually, Phyllis added to her hours as she progressively accepted 20, 30, and then 40-hour positions at the library, becoming more essential to maintaining operations all the time. Although she has been identified through the years as a clerk typist, library technician, administrative assistant, and with her most recent promotion as a supervising library assistant, Phyllis Lynch has always truly been a linchpin of the Arroyo Grande Library Enterprise. I don't know who wrote that. Phyllis is much beloved by the Arroyo Grande Library staff, volunteers, and customers. Incredibly dedicated, Phyllis is often the first to arrive in the morning and the last to leave at night. Her sense of commitment, combined with patience, graciousness, and a wicked sense of humor, make her an effective supervisor and a deeply appreciated colleague. Blessed with Midwestern charm and innate diplomacy, Phyllis is a gifted public servant. In the words of Deborah Schlanzer, Phyllis's supervisors of 20-plus years, quote, "Phyllis rises to any occasion and rolls with the punches. Few employers could ask for more." Thank you, Phyllis.
Well, I've always loved the library, and I always spent a lot of time at the library. And when I was hired at the library, I thought, this is the best. I'm getting paid to be where I love to be. And after 25 years of working with wonderful people and being at the library, I feel the same way. Thank you.
And I want to thank Phyllis for trading at the same gas station for the last 30 years.
Thank you. Sheriff Corner, Pat Hedges, please come forward, and Steve Tate.
Good morning, Pat Hedges, Sheriff Corner. First, I'd like to, before I say a few words about Steve, I'd like to thank you for this presentation that we make. I learned things about employees, and I just learned today that that Spence Graft and Steve Tate use the same hairdresser. And so it didn't become obvious until we got here today.
I look forward to that hairdresser, too.
Perhaps Steve can make a recommendation for you. Senior Deputy Steve Tate started his career with the Sheriff's Department as a correctional officer in December of 1980. After completing Hancock College Police Academy, he was promoted to Deputy Sheriff in 1985 and to Senior Deputy in 1988. During his 25-year career with the department, Senior Deputy Tate has been assigned to custody, patrol, and to detectives. In 1992, Steve was sent to the Los Angeles riots as part of the Sheriff's Department's contingent. He found this experience both challenging and fascinating. While in detectives, Senior Deputy Tate held three assignments. He was assigned as a coroner's investigator, a sexual assault investigator, and to criminal investigations handling general investigations. While in general investigations, Senior Deputy Tate was the lead investigator in two murder investigations. One case resulted in a conviction, and the other in an arrest warrant, which will be served should the suspect ever return from Mexico. As a coroner's investigator, Steve was involved in both the Crawford and Newhouse murder investigations that occurred in the city of San Luis Obispo. Steve is a certified computer voice stress analyzer and a firearms instructor for the department. Senior Deputy Tate is most proud of the approximately 40 deputies he has trained within the department for the Police Olympics and the gold and silver medals he has won while competing in the Action Pistol Olympic events. When asked to sum up his career with the Sheriff's Department, Steve simply said, "It's been a lot of fun." He said he wasn't going to say many words, so I said, "Well, give me a quote and I'll say it for you." And I'll withhold any comment on his golf game until his 30-year presentation. Congratulations, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you for this presentation today. I'd like to thank Undersheriff Bolts, Chief Albrecht, and Commander Reed for being here. As usual, they have my back, and I appreciate it. It's been an honor and a privilege serving the people of this community, and I look forward to a few more years of training some of the young people here how to do the right thing right. Thank you very much.
You want to pause, Ryan? Steve. Mary wants to take a picture.
Get up, boy. Follow instructions. Right.
Wait, I was just going to say, you want to put Pat in here, and then we'll put a golf club between
Pat.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes our presentation.
Thank you, Mrs. York.
You're welcome.
Next item on our agenda is consent. With that, I will open up to the public first. First speaker is Terry Prince, followed by Jerry Seaback.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How is everybody? Here we are again. It's been about 16 months. You guys let us have a chance to run our clinical laboratory.
Terry, you want to give us your name for the record?
My name is Terry Prince, and I'm the manager of the San Luis Obispo County Laboratory. We took that 16 months and used it as a learning experience. We found out exactly how much it costs to run our facility. We used the model budget that we had created to try to build a team that could send out bills in a timely fashion. It was much more in-depth procedure than we thought it was. I want to thank my staff, obviously. I know you guys have a tough decision ahead of you. You have to look at the report that we came up with and try to decide what to do. The only question mark I still have is revenue. We're not still sure exactly what the revenue could have been had we had a private team of experts do that for us. It's also a time when we can maybe step back and try to think of some innovative ideas on how to keep the facility itself open, even if the county chooses not to support us. A lot of decisions to be made probably in the next 3 months. Basically, I want to ask the board to keep an open mind. I think the biggest thing is to try to, like I said, preserve services in the county and to try to help my staff find homes in any private facility that might come in. We, as county employees, we had some huge hurdles ahead of us. We had issues with personnel changing the staffing rules. It became a three-month process to bring in lab assistants, which when you're trying to run seven facilities, became a huge issue to us. Again, we had underestimated the billing process. I had 1.5 FTEs of billers when I probably needed a team of at least four experts to come in and try to deal with Medi-Cal and Medicare. Thank you very much for the time that you gave us. It was really great, and I hope that we can use the information that we gleaned at the county's expense to try to figure out how to, like I said, maintain services in the county, whether you choose to keep us open and try to figure out an innovative way to try to bring more revenue in for us, or if you choose to go to the Beilinson and move forward in closure, try to keep an open mind in working with some private laboratories that can come in and use our outreach program to continue to benefit patients within the county. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Seaback, followed by Deborah Farwell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'm Jerry Seaback, 40-year county resident, resident in the city of Atascadero. And today I want to speak about and ask you to not hold the Beilinson hearing and continue to work with the staff to streamline operations and improve the revenue base for the clinical lab. This may be different to hear me, being who I am, saying this. But going back to some of the other significant decisions the board has had to grapple with in healthcare, the General Hospital inpatient unit was closed, and I supported that. The main reason, not just the fact that it cost a lot of money, but that no one was using the hospital inpatient unit at the time. By the time that it was closed, less than 10 people a day were in that hospital in the inpatient side. Then the decision to contract out for the clinical outpatient services, which has been a successful partnership now, as you've seen, I also supported that. But I think the difference there, the reason there, was a lot better service could be provided to the patients. The county's clinic patients had to go to Atascadero or to San Luis Obispo. Basically, that was the only significant operations we had. With the partnership with CHC, they got services all over the county, and the two to three times the reimbursement that CHC receives from Medi-Cal makes it a lot more easy for them to provide this a better service than they have provided, a better basic service to our outpatients. Now, neither of those conditions exist in this decision, in my view. The clinical lab is used. It's used every day. Thousands of tests are done a week. And there is a need for our mental health folks to come to a convenient facility where they understand how to deal with those people. They're a very difficult population. But I also want you to look at your staff report. It says in there there's 49,000 tests a year to private pay people who could go anywhere they want. Here's my evidence. I'm one of those. I got my blood test this morning. I've been going to the lab for many years because they have a better service, in my view, more responsive and more available. And so I'm asking you as a private citizen that you reconsider the idea of the hearing at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Farwell, followed by Reverend C. Height.
Hi, my name's Debbie Farwell, and I live in San Luis Obispo. I don't have my blood placed, but I get all my lab done at the county lab also, and I have for a long time, because they are very nice when they do it. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address the board and also ask that you do not hold debilance in hearings and carry forth on the closure or changing the provider of services for the lab. I've had the honor to serve the public for 22 years as a registered nurse here with the county. So the last time I was here, I got my plaque for 20 years, and I'm looking forward to 25. There have been some ups and downs during that time, the closure of the hospital, the privatization of the clinics. Through all of that, I've been proud to be a nurse, and I stand before you proud to have the opportunity to serve the public. That is what being a county employee is all about. About 7 years ago, I became the clinical coordinator of SART, which is a suspected abuse response team. And I'd like to thank the board for the support of SART during that time. During my time at SART, I personally have done about 300 SART exams, 34 suspect exams, and I've assisted a physician in 44 suspected child abuse exams, which are also called scans. Most of these cases have required lab work, and it's almost all been done at the county lab. They're located directly across the parking lot from us, so it allows us the opportunity to walk our patients over to the clinic if we need to use their services, and allows us to maintain some continuity of care. Sexual assault victims receive STD testing, toxicology screens, and blood alcohol testing. After a scan is done, we take the children over for blood work as ordered by the MD. On high-profile sexual assault cases and cases done with the coroners, I personally take samples of vaginal fluid directly to the lab to have them determine if sperm is present. I ask that the specimen be run stat, and I've always received prompt, confidential results. The lab staff has always been professional, caring, and diligent in doing our lab work. I have not been any part of any discussion about how future lab services will be provided to SART. I'm concerned that closure of the county clinical lab or a change in service provider will increase SART costs and will impact the care that's provided to our patients and to other agencies. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Reverend Hyde, followed by L. Barrow.
I'm speaking on B5. Artist Advocate Rev. C. Height, M.A. Request to approve a lease agreement with the Friends of the Adobe Incorporated, a nonprofit corporation for the Rios Caledonia Adobe located in the community of San Miguel. Recommended approval. Now, as an artist, I really strongly recommend that you do approve this. The Adobe is not only historic. This really is a work of art. People refer to Adobe as mud, but it is a clay deposit, and it is actually just an absolutely miraculous sculpture that people came up with this idea that they could press clay and straw into blocks and create buildings, and the loss of the adobes would be really tragic. Since you are conferencing with the city of San Luis Obispo, I strongly recommend that you pay attention and listen to the success that the city has had with funding projects. And one such project is the Art About Town, the Trout About Town, which is probably on tourist pictures all over the world now. That was a very large success in financing. I think that there are means to finance the saving of the adobes that are creative instead of and constructive instead of destructive, and that the city of San Luis Obispo has had really great success with their art projects. You have an incredible amount of artists in this community, the poor starving artist and the affluent artist alike, who are really giving of their time and their talents to all kinds of community projects. And it has been proven that these are very successful projects. I recommend that you approve this and that when you conference with the city of San Luis Obispo that you come up with creative ways of funding things. I've reviewed B5 and it says that there's no financial impact, so I would trust in standing behind this and asking you to approve this, that no one of disadvantage is going to suffer from this, because this is a project that we can't really turn our backs on. Saving the adobes is incredibly important. It's incredibly important basically to San Luis Obispo County, which is with the missions. It is a tourist destination. It's part of the heritage, and it's extremely important. And so I stand behind this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow.
Good morning. Just a brief note, board. Public. My name is Al Barrow, and I live in Los Osos. And who better to ask this question than Shirley Bianchi, who has been on the Planning Commission. Regarding B13, it shows in here that there's a modification request for the CCLOU and the LCP. Could you tell me, Mrs. Bianchi, what that procedure would be? Do you start with the planning department and then go to the Board of Supervisors and then the Coastal Commission on that modification of any element of the general plan or the LCP?
I think it would be more appropriate if someone from our planning department would answer that question.
Great.
So, Barrow, if you're done with your question, or do you need to continue to fill in your 3 minutes? If you're done, then we'll invite...
I'm sorry, sir?
Are you done with your question, sir?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Would somebody from the Planning Department approach the podium and respond to that question, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Warren Hogue, Department of Planning and Building. The way the process works with amending our general plan and ordinances in the coastal zone is we have the local hearings first with the Planning Commission and Board of Supervisors. Then we submit them to the Coastal Commission for approval as a local coastal plan or LCP amendment.
Could you repeat that a little slower, please?
Pull the microphone up a little bit more. It's not going out very loud.
The way we amend our general plan and ordinances for the coastal zone part of the county is to first hold our local hearings before the Planning Commission or Board of Supervisors. And then what the...
And first it's the advisory councils, isn't it?
Well, yes. I was talking about the official part of the process, the required public hearings. But there is referrals to the local community advisory councils, and their input is considered by both the Planning Commission and Board before they make their decisions. Once the Board approves the LCP amendment, Local Coastal Plan Amendment, it's then submitted to the Coastal Commission. It's not official until the Coastal Commission has a hearing and acts on it itself. And typically what the Coastal Commission will do is reject the application, the amendment as it's submitted, and then suggest modifications that would make it acceptable to them. In this particular case, for amendments to the ordinance on flood hazard, they did suggest some relatively minor amendments that did not seem to present problems for local implementation. So what has to happen before the action is complete and the amendments become effective is the Coastal Commission's action has to come back to your board for acknowledgement and acceptance of their modifications. Then once you do that, which is what we're asking you to do today, then evidence of that is sent back to the Coastal Commission. The executive director puts it on a Coastal Commission agenda for final acknowledgement. Then the process is done. So we're about 95% through the process on the flood hazard amendments. We're asking you to acknowledge and accept the Coastal Commission's suggested modifications. If you do that, it'll go back to them. They'll recognize your action, and then we'll be done.
Thank you. I hope that answers your question, sir. That was the last request to speak for under consent agenda item. At this time, bring it back to the board members. Ms. Bianchi, do you have any items you wish to pull?
No, I don't. Thank you.
Supervisor Lenthal?
No, sir.
Supervisor Ovid?
No.
Supervisor Patterson?
I'd just like to make a comment on B1.
Please, go ahead. Do so.
Okay. I just want to acknowledge the speakers that asked that we not hold the public hearing. I think that we should hold the public hearing and have everyone have the opportunity to speak about the issue. So I would support that today.
I want to go ahead and make a motion for the entire.
I'll move that we approve the consent agenda with the as amended.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Seeing none, a roll call, please.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mr. Ovid.
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi.
Yes.
Mr. Lenthal.
Aye.
Mr. Asajian.
Aye. Okay.
She needs a break.
Take a break.
Okay. At this time is 10:06. We'll take a 15-minute break. We'll be back at 10:21.
Ready now.
Congratulations, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I thought we came as a couple. Sorry about the goof up.
It's 10:21. I want to call the meeting back to order. First item in front of us this morning is item C1. Madam Clerk, would you please introduce that item?
Item C1 is a hearing to consider an appeal by Rosemary Carlton et al. On the Subdivision Review Board's approval of 10 conditional certificates of compliance, CO3-0416, S030174C. For property in the residential single-family land use category located on Honey Grove Lane, southeast of the intersection of Honey Grove and Story Street in the community of Napomo, 4th District. This item was continued from October 18, 2005. Recommend adoption of the resolution affirming the decision of the Subdivision Review Board and conditionally approving the application of Rosemary Carlton et al.
Ms. Miller.
Good morning, Chairperson. Members of the board, my name is Andrea Miller from County Planning. As stated, this is continued from October of last year. It is an appeal by Rosemary Carlon for 10 conditional certificates of compliance. And to familiarize again with you and the public, it is in the community of Napomo within the residential single family zoning. And here's an APN map that shows the 10 lots for this project. Here's also an aerial photo. The dark, thick boundary, of course, is the project site, and which is labeled, so you see the 10. Here's a site map also that you've seen before regarding the fence location and the 20 feet, which is considered Honey Grove. Here's a closer view of the site map that you also have seen before. And again, here's the one for the 10-foot wide easement access on the two lots, 73 and 74. Just to repeat, the issues that were raised by the appellant for the first meeting are that noticing wasn't provided to all the owners. Again, on May 2nd, 2005, during the Subdivision Review Board meeting, hearing was noticed for that meeting. All of the owners within 300 feet, including the owners covered by the application. The staff report was also sent to the person designated on the applicant, or on the application, which was the agent. At that hearing, then, it was continued to June 6th, and a separate noticing for the June 6th meeting is not required because it was continued. The second item that came up was payment of the Quimby fees, and we had changed that condition at the last meeting to state that the condition read prior to issuance of building permits rather than prior to recordation of the certificates. The third issue was the legal lot status for the building permits, and while staff recommended originally that two separate certificates of the underlying lots be issued where the house was, and I had the site plan up, the applicants do have an option to revise their application to request one non-conditional certificate for those two, so keeping it as one, which would create the one lot covered by the boundaries where the building permit was issued. So there would be one regular non-conditional certificate and eight conditional certificates of compliance with a total of nine instead of 10. The last issue brought up at the last meeting was the 10-foot wide easement access, and to show you a little bit, actually I will go back so you can see it. This was stated at a previous meeting to be required for proper neighborhood circulation access, and this was recommended by our Public Works Department during a subdivision review board hearing, and Richard Marshall is here to answer any questions that you might have on that. Now the last meeting that we had, two more issues came up, and so for the first one, it was that the lots in the rear to this project have been given certificates of compliance. These lots do not have an effect on the legal status of this property for these 10 lots, and so the conditions for this project are stated for when the owners acquired their interest in their specific property, which are different owners and different dates, and it's in your staff report. And the final issue that came up at the last meeting was the legal status of Honey Grove Lane, and also, of course, the fence location. This portion of Honey Grove fronting the properties is actually owned in fee by the county. It was as a result of a tax default in 1962. In order to comply with current standards, any fence over 3 feet in height needs to be located 10 feet from the current right-of-way, and at the time the lots are developed is when the dedication of that right-of-way needs to be offered. And I do have a modification of condition number 1B, which it currently states the owners of each individual lot shall grant the county a 25-foot right-of-way, and then actually what we're saying is they shall offer instead of grant, and that instead of it saying 25-foot right-of-way, that it say 10. And I can explain that, and this was at the recommendation of our Public Works. And if you can see on this map, I apologize for thin dotted lines, but there are a lot of lines going on. I'll use the arrow to show. This is the project site, and this right here is the site across the street that we had mentioned before. And so they have offered already an existing 20-foot right-of-way, and another 20-foot section then would be what the county owns in fee, so they would only have to offer 10 feet. Originally, they would have had to do 15, but the neighbors across the way did an extra 5, so I'd like to modify that condition. And so with that, a fence over 3 feet in height would need to be set back from an existing right-of-way. Once they come in to build, and only when they come in to build, they will then have to offer that 10 feet. And then in any fence over 3 feet in height would have to be set back from then that 10-foot right-of-way, according to our ordinance standards. So that concludes my talk on the issues, and we still recommend that you adopt the resolution affirming the decision of the Subdivision Review Board and conditionally approve the 10 Conditional Certificates of Compliance, CO3-416, 1 through 10, with the modified conditions as today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, if we'll go back to the aerial photo of the lot. As I was discussing with Mr. Fletcher, who's representing the owners and or the owner, there were concern, and I need to clarify that if we go to on C-111 and under access and improvements, number one, where it says construction permits or any other of the lots, roads, and or streets to be constructed to the following standards. We only mean that, let's say, right where that arrow is, project site, let's say that one lot was to be sold to a separate owner, and that person was to build, all what we're requiring from that individual is to do the road just in front of their property, not the whole length of the this entire 10 properties.
Yes, and the road...
Clarify that. And
yes. The road, as I mentioned before, the project site before, they will do two-thirds the standard as required by a public works recommendation. And so they will only have to do what is in front of their lot, so finish that extra,
the third. The 10-foot, whatever length that
yes.
might be.
And only in front of their lot, not all the way back to Story or down towards the rest of Honey Grove where it's out.
And for the information of Board of Supervisors, the issue of the fence... The applicant and the developer across the street have met, and we'll hear this from Mr. Fletcher as well, that that has been taken care of as we speak. With that, Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Miller, the staff recommendation is that we adopt the resolution affirming the decision of the Subdivision Review Board, yet in your staff report, you made a couple of changes from the original report relative to the Quimby fees and the affordable housing fee, that they wouldn't be due and payable until a construction permit was applied for or approved, rather than when the certificates of compliance were approved. Would that be picked up if we follow that recommendation of the SRB?
Yes, part of the recommendation is with the modified conditions, and that was one of the modified conditions that we just changed it prior to.
Okay, and
construction.
Then a question either for you or Mr. Marshall regarding the access between 73 and 74 for circulation, the easement. Why was that placed there rather than just at the end of the block, rather? The edge of 74.
Yeah, I believe it's because instead of taking 20 feet to have to be able to access, and this is a road standard, but taking 20 feet from one person versus 10 on each side, where we suggested if they build, they could do a shared driveway. They don't have to build anything. They just have to allow access. And so I believe that's why it was done. One of the slides, and I'll go to it real quick, shows how the back property owner has put easements along here, and so he has told me that he owns the ones where there aren't any easements, and if he ever sells them off, he will put that 20-foot wide easement here for him and the other property owners. So in order for the neighborhood circulation, it would go all the way through and then continue down.
Okay, but it won't create a problem in the future if it's developed beyond that block. There won't be a road on each side of 74, in other words, in
no.
the future. Okay.
Are you done?
That's all. Thank you.
Now, Ms. Miller, to follow up on Mr. Patterson's questions, if this was allowed between 73 and 74, and you go to the property in the back, and that says 34 on what I see here, and 35 is further up, would they be doing the same thing to allow traffic circulation to the back portion as well, or?
Wait, can you repeat the question? Sorry.
Okay, I'm following what I have in front of me on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
If you follow between 73 and 74, where you're recommending that we have this access circulation to improve the circulation, would that road be followed through the properties behind them, whoever owns them?
You're saying the properties that aren't actually on the screen? No, it would not continue through. It would just connect with what the easements would have in place there. He owns 34, 33, and 25 that you see. Those are the parcels. He owns all of that, and so obviously he has...
Okay, you know where the circle is, 34?
Yes.
And the lot before it, which is seems like to be the last lot behind 74?
It won't continue east-west. It would only go to 34 and then turn to the right to left.
But if we're doing it here to allow circulation, why aren't we wanting that to the back, to the properties in the back, to allow further circulation solutions?
Richard Marshall, Department of Public Works. Perhaps I can help. Andrea, do you have a land use category map or something comparable we could... The properties you're asking about are the ones that are the subject of today's action, and the ones behind them are the halves of what used to be really long, skinny lots created by a tract back in 1911. And it shows, it just jumps off the screen on this figure, and it constitutes the residential single-family land use category in this area. The next property in that same direction you're asking about changes to a different density and has plenty of access from Story Street, so we don't need to have this circulation we're talking about continue that direction. We'll be able to do enough other circulation planning entirely independent, on, and it's a different density of development on that property.
Mr. Marshall, as you mentioned, those are skinny, long properties, and taking, and I appreciate the idea of not going to the lost property, taking 20 foot, it's taking 10 from each, but still, doesn't that really impact those two pieces of properties to impose upon them to absorb the circulation of the neighborhood behind them as well?
Well, it's imposing something on them that would have been required if this subdivision had been processed the proper way in the first place. The lots in the back, in other words, those which don't directly touch Honey Grove, have very little access. They just have this one place that one of them touches Story Street, and then a long dead-end private easement that is the only access for the rest of them. If this subdivision had been processed under the rules that applied in 1978, is that the right date? We would have been talking about developing a logical circulation system for the whole neighborhood, and that's what we're trying to retrofit with this recommendation.
Again, my fear is for these two lots.
Sure. I realize I didn't really answer the question. Can I have another try?
Please, but let me ask another question
okay.
So you combine them both together. We're not asking that it will be a paved road, because my fear is this becomes an easy access to the properties in the back and will take something away from those two properties. Mm-hmm. Are you recommending this is an only an emergency access type operation? Or
no, it would just be simple access. It would be private access to those properties and not a public road. The properties are all approximately 10,000 square feet, the half lots that we're talking about, and the taking just 10 feet from any one of them still leaves plenty of developable area, and it we don't feel that it's a significant denigration of the ability to use those two properties in question. The same requirement was applied to the properties on the other side of Honey Grove and has been no problem in their construction efforts.
So if we were to go that route, the requirement is to be just a dirt road?
Well, simply we're providing an access easement that can be developed in the future when the property behind needs it for its access.
And at whose cost?
The property behind.
Property behind. Now, if I may take you, Ms. Miller, on C-112, condition number 5, or under miscellaneous.
So straddles 111, 112?
I want to go down to number 15.
Okay.
C-112. Are you there? Are you there with me? The the compliance with regulations concerning setbacks, that's already have been worked out, and I'm sure that's you want to see that in writing. But what got me thinking is, then you go on parking, storage of materials, and keeping of animals. Is this a language that's already there, and it's, or there is a problem that exists that you have you do mention it here?
No, that's just a standard that we had used on a, on the property across the way as well, just that they, because they had originally kept two houses, and so it just says that they have to meet all of those requirements. To my knowledge, there isn't any problem with keeping of animals and storage, and it was really just to cover the setbacks. But to
I didn't want to scare them that we knew something they didn't know and we're going to come back. And
yeah, no. Okay. No, the only issue currently right now is the fence.
As far as what's in front of us, we're talking about setbacks, and the other is the usual verbiage that appears on our staff report. Thank you. I see no other request to speak. This is an appeal, so allow me to do my job, Mr. Barrow. I don't see any request to speak from my board of supervisors. This is an appeal. I will start with Mr. Fletcher. You're representing the applicant. Please, would you come forward and... how much time do you think you'll be needing, and or would the other members speak, or you'll be the only speaker?
One other speaker.
One other speaker. So why don't we go 5 minutes each, since this is a continuation?
Okay. Good morning, Supervisor Agajian and supervisors. I wanted to congratulate you on your election as the chairman. I know that you're going to have some difficult decisions and projects coming up this year, like Supervisor Bianchi had last year and the good job that she did. I think this is kind of appropriate that the first project that comes before you is from your district. And I was really pleased to see the changes that I hadn't really seen up till the time the presentation this morning and the questions that you ask. And I think all of you from our previous meeting know that we feel that the Carlones were... were kind of pressured and misled into applying for the conditional certificates of compliance. Normally, certificates of compliance are only usually brought up if you go to, if you want to build. Yet at this time, these people were not only, it was brought to them by the county, which not often do you ever hear that. Plus, they were then pressured by both the staff with letters, which you have seen, and code compliance on property that was already legal. But the real important thing today is to these conditions and the ones that seem to be in change that were so onerous to the people. The ones changed, but there are all of these others. It says in there, prior to issuing of a construction permit, that all of these things have to be done on other properties, properties that not own, these are separately owned properties. And the way that I read this, and I would like that county council to say, if is that required that if one person wants to build that all the others have to meet, because it says prior to issuance of a construction on any lots, roads and streets, construction, and it went on just like it appeared in the writing, was that the whole road had to be put in before you could do one building. Is that true?
Well, that's the clarification that I asked in the very early
yes,
on.
Yes, and I
that's
appreciate
not
that.
True. It's only in front of the property that's
and
required.
We have no problem with that at right. all. But if you look at all the other ones, they all say the same thing.
And the same thing applies to all of them. It's only
in so front. That only the conditions that...
If you go to page C111, and let's go under number one, and if you go to A, the last wording, it says improvement fronting the property, and that's exactly what we mean.
Okay. Then, like, on three, if you, on conditions B, number three, it says prior to issuance of a construction permit on any lot, and that's our biggest problem.
On any lot fronting that lot.
Okay. Well, that makes a total difference because the way that this read previously that made these properties totally useless because you would have to have all 10 people agree to do these things prior for you to be able to do. So that does answer our biggest questions.
Okay. Would you like at this time, since your 5 minutes is up, introduce the follow-up speaker on the appeal?
Okay. Is Rosemary Carlon.
Okay. Rosemary, would you come forward, please, and we still need...
And again, thank you.
Yeah. You'll be given a chance at the end of the public hearing, if you heard something different, to respond.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. My name's Rosemary Carlon. And I'm the applicant for the Certificate of Compliances, that I believe that we weren't even really necessary. We have a building permit, which I think it's the law that once you are issued a building permit, your lot is legal. I had the senior planner call me numerous times until I finally had to tell him, please stop calling me. We were not interested in building anything on our property. We're just a working class family. After I told him that, yes, he did stop calling me, but I did receive a letter that we were in notice of violation of code, I don't know, blah, 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 that our property was illegal. And I believe he did know it wasn't illegal. Since he is a senior planner, he should have known that before I started receiving letters, which I think is a little... I don't want to say threatening, that's a strong word, but we just wanted to do the right thing. So I feel like we were pressured and misled into purchasing these certificates. And I believe this harassment was to help the developers and the road, which, you know, I'd like a uniform road too. I have nothing against these developers. They want to develop, but not at our expense, not on our property. Also, who would buy these certificates with all these conditions added on? I appreciate some of the changes, but I still have a problem with my fence. It has come to the conclusion that our fence... Our first lot, our fence is on the property line, but it turns out it goes out into the road, which is fine. You know, we already worked it out with the developers that I guess they're going to replace our fence. But I still don't agree with us having to move our fence 10 feet back. This is our yard, and we value our privacy. And a three-foot fence is not going to do it. So, and I want to see some kind of documentation where it says that that's what the way it has to be, 3 feet. I mean, is that a new ordinance, or is it just put on our certificate? And um, And I also agree with Mr. Fletcher. I think it's unusual that a planner would contact me about legalizing our lots. I mean, I always believe that once you apply for a permit, that's when you start making contact with planners and everybody else in the county. We also received letters from Marie Cohen, who is a code enforcement officer. Started out nice, but we were told in the letter that if we did not remove our fence within a certain amount of time, that we were going to be fined $500 a day until the fence was removed. And it turns out our fence isn't really that much over the property line. And I would ask her, well, where exactly does our fence need to be? And she couldn't even answer me that. She could not give me an answer, yet I'm receiving these, not only a letter, but also phone calls from Marie Cohen. I mean, I want all of this over. You know, I wish the developers the best, but I also want what's right for us. That's all I'm asking. What's right and what's fair. That's all I want. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll respond to the height of the fence, and in absence of Mrs. Cohen, in her defense, as we met with the applicants and Mr. Fletcher, she did say that was the letter, but she wasn't going to enforce it till we had come to this hearing and worked out our differences. That was verbally communicated with all of us at that time. Ms. Miller, on the issue of the 3 feet fence, or Mr. Hoge, is that because it's a corner property and visibility is an issue for traffic when you're turning left or right, or where does it come from?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Warren Hoke, Department of Planning and Building. Yes, that's partially it. First, you know, where do these requirements come from? The requirement for a 3 foot high fence inside setbacks adjacent to streets comes from the county land use ordinance, and it's been a requirement for many years, as well as the requirement for, you know, how far the setbacks are. At this point, the Honey Grove Lane would be considered the frontage of the applicant's property would be considered a street side. And so it's a 10-foot setback instead of the larger front setback. The front setback is instead measured from story. And the reason for an increased street side setback for fences over 3 feet in height is just as you suggested. It's to make sure that added visual clearance for vehicles going up and down the street.
But that doesn't stop them if they want to do landscaping that grow over 3 feet behind the fence. That's their authority.
The ordinance does not address landscaping.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I will go to the public. Mr. L. Barrow.
Good evening. I am in sympathy with the woman who is complaining about the fence. I've the easement in streets it was used in our community for landscaping, drainage, all kinds of different things. So you have my sympathy. I'm an affordable housing advocate, and I have the Coalition for Low-Income Housing. And I just got off the phone with the people in charge of affordable housing, Dana Lilly. And he confirmed to me that this development only requires an in lieu of fees, which of course has not and never has addressed our housing stock for low income or moderate income or working class folks. So this is more or less of a general comment in that I want to encourage the board, and I do thank Cacho for inviting me to have a meeting with him on some of these other issues. Regarding the affordability, and then there's one, the Quimby, the park issue on condition 18, and I'm trying to sort this out. I think we have a complaint from an individual property owner, but there's a developer who wants to develop 10 units, and those are residential units. Is that correct?
That's across the street. That's already approved project.
Already approved?
That's not what's in front of us, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. And with that, bring it back to Mr. Fletcher if you have final comments.
Some of those conditions that say still prior to development on any property. They go into all kinds of things like flood control and retention basins. Whose property would they be put on? The conditions that appeared to be for a developer, not for individual lots. And I'm still concerned about taking 20 feet of a person's property without compensation when the people in the back have the ability to put a road in on their own property. There's an easement there. It does seem that it is a taking of private property. Other than that, I'm very pleased that these are not being, the conditions are not prior to development of any property that everybody has to agree. That would have seemed to me made all the properties useless because no one would have bought them, because the conditions that are in here, if one person had to do them, would be hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, if one person was developing the entire property, it would be another story. But as we said, and my assurance is, as it says under C-111, item A, improvement fronting the property, which was a real issue for you, that's spelled out here.
Yeah.
And whenever somebody comes forward to put a house on any one of those properties, have to go through the proper process.
Proper building permits.
It seems to me that
a proper building permit requires all these things. So why should they be put on these lots if they, like the lots behind, they were given a certificates without any conditions. But if you wanted to build, you have to have access, sewer, water.
I think now, the conditions that I'm looking at, it's pretty much an understanding that even if you had a certificate of compliance on any one of those properties, you were to go through the process.
Sure.
The requirement for easement and all that, as you know with your experience, will come up. I think we're just being upfront here, not necessarily conditioning, but having an understanding that what the future will require.
Okay, and one of the others that I noticed in there was prior to any building permit on any property that the Corleones would have to hook up to the sewer. Now that's on somebody else's property if you wanted to build on yours. I'm sure that they would like to hook up to the sewer once it's available, but now the sewer is not available until that line is put in, and yet that's one of the conditions that I see on this permit.
Would you take us to that condition? So
yeah, okay.
Because how far is this from NCSD's lines, do we know?
Is it 12 and 13?
12 and 13. No. No, no, not. Okay, it would be
19 and 20 under community sewer and water.
It's 12 and 13.
14. Prior to development on any property, lots 65 and 60 shall be tied to the sewer. Now, that sure would make it difficult for one of the other people.
Now, help me.
Prior to development on any property,
to clarify,
65 and 67, I have to be hooked to the sewer.
County staff, Andrea Miller. To clarify that, it's on, if there were just one lot that we were speaking of, it wouldn't say on any property, but we're meaning any property, lots 65, 66, and 67 would have to be hooked up because there currently is a house there.
It's on a sewer tank as it is, as we speak. The current house has a sewer tank.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
How close is the sewer line?
I'll refer to Richard Marshall.
Richard Marshall, Department of Public Works. The construction plans for the developer across the street include their proposal to install a sewer main down Honey Grove at their expense. So it will be fronting all of these properties shortly.
So, and it is a personal opinion, if there's a sewer line going by and if I want to build a home, you know, if I connect, I think it gives more value to my property.
Oh, sure.
Than otherwise. So I would think in the long run this will be an asset for the property.
But that's not what it says here.
Mr. Chairman, can I offer a suggestion? You're looking at condition 14, and I think the concern is less with how far away the sewer is than the fact that the 10 parcels in question are not all owned by the same party.
Right.
Perhaps if condition 14 were amended to say, prior to the development of partial lots 65 to 67, comma, these lots shall be tied into the sewer system.
But there is an existing...
that's the place where the existing house is.
House is, and I personally, they're there, and they're being living there, and till such time that they want to do something different, I want to leave them alone.
Right. So that requirement wouldn't kick in until they want to do something.
Okay.
Nor would it require anything of anybody who owns the other seven lots.
Right. Well, so as we speak, they can go forward with their lives without us imposing anything on them till such time if they want to bulldoze the house and put individual house and things of that nature, which then is understood. So can we clarify that language? Would the County Council and Mr. Marshall help us?
Mr. Hoag suggested to me that it should read as follows. Prior to further development of partial lots 65 to 67, these lots shall be tied into the sewer system and the existing septic tanks formally abandoned.
Okay. Now, does that mean that they're not to do anything as we speak?
That's correct.
That's whatever the future brings. Okay.
Until they want to further develop those lots, nothing is required, and nothing at all is required on that property by the owners of the other
properties. They can go on with their lives with the exception of the fence.
With the exception
taken care of by the developer at Broad Street.
Would that also be on number 6 and number 3 and number 1?
Yeah. Well, number 1, 3, and 6 do not make reference to individual properties the way number 14 did.
I think it's prior to issuance of a construction on any lot, the improvement plans, every one of them says prior construction on any lot.
Yes, Supervisor Shajian has, I think, pretty well explained that to you, that it says those requirements apply to that lot.
Only fronting that lot.
It says it.
Yes.
If those had been in before, you probably wouldn't have had a...
Let me bring it to here, and I'll come to you in a second. Okay, any other concerns, Mr. Fletcher? Because I'm going to close to the public and bring it back to supervisors.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. And appreciate your efforts and the applicant's efforts to meet with the developers and take care of the issue of
and
the
we will,
fence.
We'll see these all in rewritten...
It's recorded, Sarge, and we'll be sure that when the motion is made... We'll make a mention of what's being talked here. I know Ms. Bianchi want to say something, but Mr. Lentil, light is on, but out of courtesy, we go to the Queen. Ms. Bianchi?
Well, actually...
You may be seated, Mr. Fletcher.
I may Thank still you. Be Mr. Lentil on the screen.
Oh, we haven't changed those. Okay, I have to pay attention to that.
On those conditions, what was it, 1, 3, and 6, I think it is, it seems to me if you would change the language to prior to issuance of construction permits on any one of the lots on that lot, and then go ahead with the rest of the sentence. And that would make it more obvious that it's any one of the lots and only on that lot, on those, you know, those three conditions that are still questionable. So that's my suggestion.
Okay, if there are no other questions, and with these corrections, may I entertain a motion? Mr. Patterson?
I'll go ahead and make a motion that we approve staff's recommendation as amended, and then in items 3 and 6, probably more so than 1, refers to individual lots.
Well, one it does it also.
No, 1 it does. When you go read A, B, and C, it talks about fronting.
Improving fronting the property, yeah.
So that takes care of it. But in 3 and 6, if we can make a priority issue and a construction permit on any single lot.
I'll second that motion.
Also, there was the change from grant to offer. And
yeah, right. That's what I meant by the amendment. Because we did the other one, we amended
14, as Mr. Marshall introduced, we have that, Madam Clerk?
Yes.
Okay. There's a motion by Supervisor Ovid, seconded by Supervisor Patterson. Any further discussion? Seeing none, roll call, please.
Mr. Ovid.
Aye.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi.
Yes.
Mr. Lintenthal.
Aye.
Mr. Asajian.
Aye. Thank you. Would you please introduce the next item?
Item C2 is a hearing to consider 1, ordinance repealing the County Code Section 2.20.060, which consolidates the duties of the Health Agency Director and Public Guardian, 2, amending 2.20.030 to allow the Health Agency Director to recommend the appointment of the Public Guardian to the Board of Supervisors, and 3, upon the effective date of the ordinance, the Board approved the appointment of Gregory Thomas, M.D., as a Public Guardian of the County. Recommend approval and instruct Chairperson to sign.
Dr. Thomas?
Good morning. Greg Thomas, Health Officer and Public Health Administrator. In 2004, the health agency was established, reestablished, with the primary goal of consolidating administrative and financial support systems within public health and behavioral health. That ordinance also reestablished the position of the health agency director, who has overall responsibility for organizational, fiscal, and operational functions in the health agency. And at that time, it was added that the health agency director would assume the duties of the public guardian. Based on the health agency director's review of the public health administration structure after he's been here for 10 months, it's felt that it's more appropriate to continue to designate the public guardian with the health officer and public health administrator. Frankly, it has not been changed during his tenure here. This assumes more direct authority in the organizational structure and continuity of services for the public guardian clients. The public guardian office provides services to the elderly and mentally disabled adults who are unable to independently provide for food, clothing, and shelter. The court provides for the appointment of the public guardian when no other qualified individual or entity is willing to act. The board must hold a public hearing to repeal Chapter 2.20.060 to amend the chapter. And upon the effective date of the ordinance, the health agency director is recommending that the board appoint myself, Gregory Thomas, M.D., as public guardian. That's the end of my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. Questions from board members? Seeing none, we'll go to the public. Reverend C. Height.
I first want to read something that's in today's paper about health care costs taking a bigger economic bite. Whereas $1 in $6 produced in the nation's gross product, which is 8%, was used in 2004. Home health services for elder and disabled people with disabilities jumped to 13.3% in 2004. And when I look at this, I see some conflict of interest in C2. It seems more like dog in the manger than fox guarding the hen house. When it says ordinance repealed, which would consolidate the duties of the health director and the public guardian, I think that that's definitely a conflict of interest and I would agree with number one. They shouldn't be the same person, because I'm going to remind you that county public health is part of a county partnership of housing and social services, and that you have a human services, affordable housing, and a health care crisis. And the results of failure in this county is people who are who are just not able to manage their funds and are becoming dependent, more dependent on services, more dependent on the county, and more dependent on county health and the public guardian. In 2002, the department, the Social Security Administration, determined that the public guardian gave inadequate access to funds, and they acted accordingly. Prior to that, DSS, the Department of Social Services, was found to have mishandled over 70% of their cases involving children while a Social Security payee. Now, when you want the health director, if it's a conflict of interest for the health director to also be the public guardian, then you're going to allow them to appoint the public guardian, and then you're going to allow Thomas, who has been, if I'm not mistaken, the health director, to be the public guardian. I'm going to say that there's an assembly bill that is passed in California that speaks to the point of exactly what's happening in this county, and that is they're trying to get public health to realize that their decisions are lending themselves towards institutionalization of the disabled and dependence of the disabled, which is right where the public guardian comes in. And I really want to ask, when the board was when it was brought to the board's attention and the research was offered about how the county had a high suicide rate, if you watch the paper, it took about a year for Thomas to respond to that. Where was Thomas when they decided to make the brilliant decision to fire the pediatricians? And just following an article in the paper where it stated that the pediatricians were actually the intermediary and the advocates of at-risk families, where was Thomas as disabled people are being prosecuted for medical marijuana? I just think that this is a mistake.
Thank you, Ms. Hyde. See, not a request from the public to speak. Bring it back to the board. For any discussion, comments, and or a motion?
Move staff recommendation.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Bianchi, seconded by Supervisor Ovid. Any further discussion? Seeing none, a roll call, please.
Mrs. Bianchi.
Yes.
Mr. Ovid.
Aye.
Mr. Linthal.
Aye.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mr. Asajian.
Aye. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Thomas. We'll be moving to closed session, and I have two requests to speak. First is Michael Wynn, followed by Reverend C. Hyde.
Good morning, Chairman Asajian and supervisors. I wasn't sure that there was anything I needed to show up for today until I heard on the radio on the way that you were adding an item in your closed session. And so I want to encourage you, as you look at the item, Napomo Community Services District versus the County of San Luis Obispo, that we continue the momentum that you began in your previous meetings in recognizing level severity in the water in the area. I would like to see the litigation about Summit Station resolved amicably. I think we're well on our way to that. I do think it's important that the area planning standards that you're committed to in a general sense gets worked out in a detailed sense that actually works. And I know we look forward to working with you to make sure that that's something we can mutually agree on. Thank you.
Thank you. Reverend Hyde.
It's Reverend C. Hyde, M.A. I see that under your significant exposure, it always remains at 2 in the circumstance unknown. And I highly recommend that you quit making decisions that exposes the county. It's a service that I offer in which I present to you where you're significantly exposed, and my qualifications are now part of a Superior Court record, and they went uncontested, and that also is recorded. Your significant exposure lies in the fact that I've exhausted remedy in the County of San Luis Obispo, and I can prove that any individual simply trying to educate their child and inquire about services, apply for services, or I can't say, God forbid, can I complain about the lack of services, is going to suffer substantial loss, retaliation. and the loss is going to be significant. Your significant exposure lies in the fact that there is now an assembly bill that is going to dictate to the state of California that anyone that receives state and federal funds needs to consider that when you create failure, when you maintain an affordable and public housing crisis, when you maintain an exclusive community through a health care crisis and a human services crisis, that you are driving people into institutionalization and dependency. And institutionalization includes coming before the DA, and the DA is actively prosecuting disabled people. Your significant exposure lies in the fact that you are conferencing with, apparently, according to the news article, correct me if I'm wrong, that you're conferencing over absconding with an $100,000 grant that's meant for disabled compliance and housing. And your significant exposure lies in the fact that within the county of San Luis Obispo, you allow the city to institutionalize martial law, disadvantage every other citizen, and pour over $1 million into Mardi Gras oppression, while your county administrator invites people from New Orleans, from the terrible hurricanes, to the county, while you have no services to offer them. Your significant exposure lies in the fact that you allow the city to administer the housing program when the demographics show that the majority of the disabled people are not in the city of San Luis Obispo. They have no representation. They have no transportation to the city meetings. And when the city holds a meeting and someone complains about the issues with the housing authority, they're told that the city has nothing to do with it. When they attend the commission, they're treated adversarially, and they're denied a basic opportunity that's allowed any other citizen, and they're confronted with the fact that they would like to record and prove what's said to them.
Thank you, Ms. Seid. Mr. Lindem, do you have anything to add?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, at this time we'll move to the closed session, and we'll report back from the closed session at 2 o'clock when we return this afternoon. Thank you. We'll go upstairs for the meeting.